Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Indestructible Jews by Max I. DeMont, narrated by Barry Abrams. A Fable of Our Times. On the wall of a subway station in New York, someone had scrawled, "God is dead," Nietzsche. Someone else had crossed it out and scrawled underneath, "Nietzsche is dead. God." Preface. For all too long, Jews and Christians have distorted Jewish history with so many pious frauds and smothered it with so much pious mythology that at times it has been difficult for scholar or layman to perceive its real grandeur. It was not always thus. The Old Testament, most of it unequaled for sheer narrative skill, gives us an entirely different picture of Jewish history, proud, grand, and dynamic. It is also the first historical record, in the modern sense of the word, so accurate that an archaeologist can go to where the Bible said things happened and find the evidence. The Greeks and Romans patterned their historical writings on the Jewish idea of history as a continuous biography of a people. But with the decline of Greece and the fall of Rome, the writing of objective history disappeared for close to 1,000 years. After the Renaissance, it became the fashion in church circles to denigrate Jewish history in order to ennoble the Christian view of things, thus reducing Jewish history to a meaningless minor footnote. In ghetto circles, it became fashionable to count dead Jews in order to enhance Jewish suffering, thus reducing Jewish history to a meaningless, boring dirge. In the 19th century, with the era of the German Enlightenment, Aufklärung, so-called scientific Judaism was born. A more apt phrase would be public relations Judaism. In their eagerness to portray Jews to Christians as nice, tolerant, tax-paying citizens, German Reform Jewish scholars began to suppress anything they thought was unfavorable to the Jews. In their works, the Jew emerged as an innocent schnook, pushed by predatory Christians to the slaughter bench of history. Retroactively, they conferred the crown of martyrdom on Jews all the way back to Abraham. With the 20th century, scholars at last began to discard the stereotypes of church, ghetto, and apologetes. Modern scholars, both Jewish and Christian, began to re-examine Jewish history with new, objective, critical eyes. Jewish scholars especially began to arm themselves with general world history, religious and secular. They let the facts fall where they would, and as obscuring myths were discarded, Jewish history was revealed in a new light. History can be compared to a vast smorgasbord, with the facts spread on a prepared table like exotic dishes, each vying for attention. There are two ways the historian can serve himself. He can close his eyes and help himself to a chance sampling of what the table has to offer, in which case he would have that highly praised mode of history known as objective. Or he can select those facts that suit his concept of history, in which case he would construct that highly criticized mode of history known as interpretive. We prefer the second school because, to paraphrase an epigram by Oscar Wilde, objective history gives us the dates of everything and the meaning of nothing. Facts in themselves have no intrinsic worth other than they happened. Meaning can come only after facts have been sifted through the human mind and clothed with value. The same holds true for every great work of art, which is not only an aesthetic presentation, but a statement of value as well. For example, the Duke of Ferrara in Browning's My Last Duchess kills his wife because of her inability to make value judgments. In Browning's words, the Duke's complaint was, "Sir, 'twas all one, my favor at her breast, the dropping of the daylight in the west. The bow of cherries some officious fool broke in the orchard for her, the white mules she rode with round the terrace. All and each would draw from her alike the approving speech, or blush at least. She thanked men, good, but thanked somehow, I know not, as if she ranked my gift of a 900-years-old name with anybody's gift. Just as the Duke demanded from his Duchess a value differentiation between a bow of cherries and his 900-years-old name, so a reader can demand that a historian makes a value differentiation between an earthquake killing a million people and a dictator ordering the murder of a like number of people. Not the quantity, but the morality of the act is the meaningful factor. One need only read the contradictory accounts of the Reformation by Catholic and Protestant scholars to appreciate the difference interpretation makes. Though all may agree on dates, names, events, they all may disagree as to their meaning and relative importance. Yet such divergences of opinion are essential, for an important task of the historian is to render a moral judgment. There is also a presumption among many scholars that responsible thought can be expressed only in scholarly language, but thought should not hide its meaning in turgid sentences. History is too important to be smothered by obscure writing. Scholarship does not die with lucidity or vanish in the warmth of a smile. We hold there is nothing unscholarly in writing in the American vernacular, nor should one hesitate to employ an apt cliché, which, like a metaphor in poetry, can give instant understanding. Some listeners may note the general omission of works by Jewish historians of yesteryear, whose writings so greatly contributed to the popular concept of Jewish history as a saga of specialized suffering. Rather, we have emphasized the works of modern scholars who have cleared paths through a jungle of otherwise meaningless facts. If this author's vision of Jewish history extends beyond the customary horizons, it is because he stands on the shoulders of this new breed of scholars who have pioneered in the new historiography. Thus, our views on Jews in Babylonian and Hellenic times are not based on the judgments of the 19th century historians, no matter how revered their names, but on the works of 20th century writers like Jacob Neusner, Saul Lieberman, and Victor Cherikover. Our concept of Jesus and his times has been fashioned not by the pious pronouncements of Christian theologians or intemperate tracts by Jewish zealots, but by the works of such objective scholars, Christian and Jewish, as Charles Guinibert, Paul Winter, and Hugo Mantel. Our observations on the Talmud and Talmudists were inspired by the scholarship of such men as Harry A. Wolfson, Louis Jacobs, and Boaz Cohen. Our understanding of the Messianic eschatology was deepened by such pioneering works as The Pursuit of the Millennium by Norman Cohen, Political Messianism by J. L. Talman, and A History of Messianic Speculation in Israel by Abba Hillel Silver. Introduction. Illusions of History. Man, God, and the Clash of Ideas. Jewish history consists of a unique series of events, accidental or purposive, which have had the practical effect of preserving the Jews as Jews in an exile to fulfill their avowed mission of ushering in a brotherhood of man. Whether this mission was initiated by God or retroactively attributed to God by the Jews themselves in no way alters our thesis of a Jewish manifest destiny. We further contend that far from being a curse, the exile of the Jews is a blessing. It is not a punishment for sins, but a key factor in Jewish survival. Instead of dooming the Jews to extinction, it funneled them into freedom. The unique and majestic flow of the Jewish saga is often lost sight of because it is obscured by the artificial plateaus of history, known as ancient, medieval, and modern. But if we were to view history as the ebb and flow of civilizations shaped by the clash of ideas, rather than see it as the rise and fall of empires shaped by fortunes of war, we would perceive a more meaningful unfolding of Jewish destiny. To behold such a total panorama of Jewish history as it flows within the context of world history the listener is invited to step outside the usual chronological anchorage of events and survey the past from a different frame of reference. From this new vantage point, he will behold world history not as a succession of dynasties, but as tidal waves of civilizations. He will see the Akkadian, Sumerian city-states and the Egyptian kingdom sweep in on the shores of the planet Earth, followed by the emergence of the Babylonian and Assyrian empires. These, in turn, are inundated by the Persian tidal wave of success. Persia is washed away by the Greek idea, and the Greeks are then engulfed by the legions of Rome. Next, the Byzantine and Islamic civilizations flood over the shores of history, and feudalism rises in Europe. Finally, he will see the modern age wade in on the stilts of capitalism and industrialism. But where are the Jews? We have raced through 5,000 years of history and not beheld a single one. We know they are there somewhere, so we look again, more closely this time. And we do see them, but in a most peculiar position. They are riding cultural surfboards on the crests of these tidal waves, precariously bobbing up and down with the rising and falling fortunes of these civilizations. As we continue to watch this phenomenon, we behold another unique sight. After the flow of a civilization has reached its high point, we see it slowly ebb and ultimately sink into the depths of historical oblivion. And we see the Jews in that civilization go down with it. But whereas each sunken civilization remains submerged, the Jews emerge time and again from seeming doom, riding the crest of a new civilization rolling in where the old one once flowed. The Jews make their first appearance in history in the Babylonian world, about 2000 BC. When the Babylonian state disappears, the Jews make their entry in the Persian Empire. As the Persian world disintegrates, they announce their debut in the Hellenic drawing room. When Rome conquers the world, they settle in Western Europe, helping the Romans carry the banners of business enterprise into barbaric Gaul. When the star of Islam rises, the Jews rise with it to a golden age of intellectual creativity. When feudalism settles over Europe, they open shop as its bankers and scholars. And when the modern age struts in, we find them sitting on the architectural staff, shaping it. If we now shift our sights from a general view of the history of civilizations to focus on that of the Jews only, we see an equally incredible succession of events. We see Jewish history begin with one man, Abraham, who introduces a new concept to the world, monotheism, which he hands to his descendants. Now Jewish history hits the roads of the world. After a nomadic existence in Canaan, enslavement in Egypt, and settlement of Palestine, after defeat by the Assyrians, captivity by the Babylonians, and freedom under the Persians, after an intellectual clash with the Greeks, strife under the Maccabeans, and dispersion by the Romans, after flourishing as mathematicians, poets, and scientists under Muslim rule, after surviving as scholars, businessmen, and ghetto tenants under feudal lords, after surviving as statesmen, avant-garde intellectuals, and concentration camp victims in the modern age, a small segment of these descendants of Abraham return, after a 2,000-year absence, to re-establish Israel, while the rest choose to remain in the world at large in a self-imposed exile. Such a succession of events would be improbable were it not historic fact. What can we make of these events? Are they mere accidents of history? Are they but blind, stumbling, meaningless facts, a series of causes and effects without a definite design? Or is this improbable succession of events part of what philosophers call teleologic history, that is, a succession of events having a predetermined purpose? If so, who drafted such a blueprint? God or the Jews themselves? Why would God choose the Jews as his messengers for a divine mission? Or, to use William Norman Ewer's trenchant phrase, how odd of God to choose the Jews. The equally trenchant rejoinder by Leon Roth is, it's not so odd, the Jews chose God. If God had a need for messengers to carry out a mission, he would have to choose someone. Therefore, why not the Jews? History has proved it not a bad choice. Thus far, at least, God has been able to depend on them. On the other hand, what if the Jews themselves drafted their own blueprint and then attributed it to God? The answer depends not only on faith, but on how one views history. Voltaire, representing the rationalist view, saw history as little else than a picture of human crimes and misfortunes. Jews, representing the humanistic view, attempted to invest history with a moral purposiveness. Therefore, it was not survival for its own sake that guided them through the obstacle course of their history. They never jettisoned their idea even in the hour of peril, but were forever mindful of the verse in Proverbs, chapter 29, verse 18, where there is no vision, the people perish. We must view the Odyssey of the Jews as a clash of ideas that eventually conquered men's minds and ushered in a new world of thought. This intellectual adventure is a leitmotif that runs through four millennia of Jewish history, and parallel to it runs that enigma of Jewish history, the exile, or diaspora. The term diaspora, however, does not mean exile, for Jews do not refer to themselves as being in exile, but say they live in the diaspora. This Greek word, meaning a dispersal, has come to signify that body of Jews not living in the state of Israel, but having residence outside that land. What the Jews themselves have thought of the diaspora through the millennia shaped their history more profoundly than did events. And in the end, their unique way of thinking about themselves produced three pronounced and fundamental differences between Jewish history and the history of other peoples. What are these three differences? First, there have been 20 to 30 civilized societies in the history of mankind, the number depending on how one defines a civilization. The usual lifespan of a civilization as a culture-producing entity has been 500 to 1,000 years. Then the civilization has either stagnated or disintegrated. The Jews are seemingly the only exception to this rule. Second, the moment a people lost its country through war or some other calamity, that people either disappeared as an ethnic entity or regressed into a meaningless existence. The Jews, however, though conquered time and again, though exiled from their homeland, did not die out. Against the odds of history, they survived for 2,000 years without a country of their own. Third, no people except the Jews has ever managed to create a culture in exile. The Jews, however, in exile created not just one but six different cultures, one in each of the six major civilizations within which their history flowed. When we stated that the normal lifespan of a civilization is but 500 to 1,000 years, we were not speaking of survival in a biological sense. In such a sense, the modern Greeks are the descendants of Homer's heroes just as much as the modern Jews are the descendants of the biblical Abraham. We are referring to the continuity of those ideas that spark a culture. When that continuity is disrupted, the culture dies. In such a sense, the Greeks today are no longer of the same culture as the Greeks of Homer's time, and the Egyptians today are not of the same culture as the Egyptians of the time of the pharaohs. But the Jews today are still of the same culture and the same people as the Jews of yesteryear. They represent a continuum of ideas that extends unbroken 4,000 years back into history, back to Abraham. Why is Jewish history so different? Why are the Jews seemingly indestructible? Why were they able to survive where others did not? Why were they able to create new cultures in alien civilizations, whereas others were not? How shall we view this incredible history of the Jews? Is there an element in Jewish history which exempts it from the normal historical process of decay? Was it guided by a divinity, or did the Jews shape their own destiny? Have historians perhaps obscured the past with too many irrelevant facts? Consonant with our theory that Jewish history consists of an onslaught of ideas that toppled empires and ushered in a new world thought, we must discard the usual stereotypes of Jewish history, free it from the shackles imposed on it by friend and foe, and demonstrate not only the source of its indestructibility, but also the nature of its vitality. Instead of viewing Jewish history as the unfolding of political events manipulated by man, a succession of kings, wars, and betrayals, let us view it as the unfolding of a manifest drama motivated by ideas, a succession of steps leading to a brotherhood of man. Let us suppose that a playwright some 4,000 years ago decided to draft a play about a people whose task would be to bring about an ultimate brotherhood of man. What are some of the difficulties that dramatizing such a unique theme would pose? First, our mythical playwright would have to choose a people for his mission, arbitrarily or intuitively, and then he would have to embed the message so deeply into their collective consciousness that it would not be forgotten throughout the centuries it would take to accomplish such an ambitious task. He would have to think up ways and means of ensuring the survival of his chosen messenger people. He would also have to think of some method whereby they could come into contact with all the nations on earth in order to accomplish their mission. Now, let us suppose that to solve this dual problem, our playwright conceived of a special exile, which would ensure his chosen people the means of coming into contact with the nations of the world, and at the same time would establish the condition for their continuous survival. Instead of beginning with an already existing people whom he would have to re-educate, he would begin with a tabula rasa, with a clean slate on which he could inscribe the mission. Instead of choosing an entire people all at once, he would begin with one man and his family, whom he could then make the progenitor of his chosen people. Each generation would pass on to its children the sacredness of the mission. The families would grow into tribes, the tribes into a nation, and this nation would be dispersed among the people of the world. As brotherly love, especially the universal variety, could not be imposed by the sword, but would have to be accepted by the mind, there would be no point in our playwright's providing his chosen people with a retinue of brilliant generals to conquer the world. He would have to endow them with a panoply of great prophets who would inspire the ideas for conquering men's minds. Curiously enough, whether by blind accident, human choice, or divine design, the first 2,000 years of Jewish history seem to constitute just such a succession of fortuitous circumstances, deliberate steps, or prearranged plans that develop into a training program for survival in a coming exile. Curiously enough, the second 2,000 years of Jewish history does institute an exile for the Jews in which they are seemingly unhinged from the historical process of cultural decay. And curiously enough, there are indications that in the future third 2,000 years of Jewish history, the Jewish idea of a universal brotherhood may be the only antidote to the anxieties generated by man's indiscriminate destruction of the ecological balance of the world and the concentration of atomic power in his hands. No dramatist could have devised a better sequence of events than that which actually happened. We are not concerned with whether what took place was an accidental sequence or a manipulated series, or whether it was God himself who blueprinted both. Such debates should be left to chronologists, humanists, and theologians. We are impressed by the fact that whichever viewpoint one chooses in no way alters the fascinating, incredible succession of events themselves. Though history regrettably has not provided us with such a dramatist, it has fortuitously bequeathed us a 16th century Jewish Kabbalist, a mystic philosopher named Isaac Luria, whose ideas constitute a perfect outline for such a drama. Facts about Luria are meager. Born in Jerusalem in 1534 and educated in Egypt, he was buried in Palestine in 1572. According to pious legends, Luria immersed himself in the Kabbalah at the age of 6, acquiring his Kabbalistic wisdom in cheerless, bleak, one-room schools, which today would be considered unfit for the culturally deprived. His learning soon earned him a reputation as a saint, but Luria lived the life of an ascetic on weekdays only. On the Sabbath, he came home to his wife and sired a brood of children. Like Jesus, Luria wrote nothing down. He merely taught. Just as we have to depend on Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John for what Jesus said, so we have to depend on the disciples of Luria for what he said. The Kabbalistic teachings by Luria's apostles made a tremendous impact not only on Jewish life, but on Christian thought. Via the new printing press, Luria's thoughts in their original Hebrew and in Latin translations found their way into Jewish ghettos and Christian universities. Luria, according to his disciples, developed a remarkable theory of the evolution of mind, matter, and history, a philosophy of the exile and redemption of man that can be interpreted on many levels. Stripped of its metaphysical language, Luria states that all matter, thought, and human experience pass through three stages or cycles. The first stage Luria called the Tzimtzum, the contraction. In Hegelian terminology, this would be the thesis of history, that is, the statement. This first stage is a cosmic drama that ushers in world history and the special role of the Jews. Here, Luria saw a twofold action taking place. As God brings all the dissident elements of Jewish history into a thesis of world history, God also simultaneously withdraws himself from that which he has created and retreats into an exile within himself. The second stage, Luria calls Shevirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels. In Hegelian terminology, this would be the antithesis, that is, the counterstatement. In this phase, everything that had been brought together in the first stage is shattered, and the Jews are strewn as exiled lights over the face of the earth. Now both Jews and God are in exile. This second stage is a cosmological drama that determines man's place in it. The third stage Luria called the Tikkun, the restoration. Again, in Hegelian terminology, this would be the synthesis, the joining of the statement and the counterstatement into a new, higher concept. In this stage, all that was shattered in the second is unified into a new, greater, and final totality. The process of tikkun corresponds to the process of mundane history. The meta-historical process and the religious acts of the Jews prepare the way for the final restitution of all the scattered and exiled lights. The redemption of Israel concludes the redemption of all things. We propose in this book to present the idea of Jewish history dramatically by transposing Luria's three stages into three acts, each act 2,000 years long. We shall fit the 4,000-year history of the Jews into the first two acts. Then we will permit ourselves to speculate about Jewish and world destiny in the subsequent 2,000 years, the third act. Our first act, extending in time from Abraham to Jesus, will serve to prepare the Jews emotionally and intellectually for survival in a diaspora. Our second act, extending in time from Jesus to Ben-Gurion, the Jews are strewn as exiled lights throughout the diaspora in order to accomplish their mission. Our third act, extending in time from Ben-Gurion to 2,000 years into the future, will usher in the final accomplishment of the Jews, the messianic age of man on earth. Prelude to Act 1. Prescription for Survival. When the curtain rises on the first 2,000 years of Jewish history that comprise our first act, we will note that it proceeds like a Greek predestination drama, with God seemingly the author and divine director. But whereas in a Greek predestination drama the characters are not aware of their ultimate destiny as they are pathetically driven toward it by remorseless gods, the participants in our Jewish predestination.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?